Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome along to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Now, to begin with, in a few moments' time, the Nearby Business News Desk with myself and Dave, where we look at some of today's business headlines.
And this week we'll be joined shortly by the economist Alan McQuaid to take an in-depth look at where our local and national and global economy is heading in these unprecedented times.
In our weekly radio column this week, Jenny Tyrrell takes a look at why Bord Gáis is now looking at biomethane.
And after that, Conor Burke is here with this Business Week in History.
Finally then, a little later in the programme, David Bell from the HR department will be along for our regular look at HR issues from the employer's point of view. This week, an interesting topic called Managing Boomerang Employees. All will be revealed a little later. Now, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or indeed comment on any of the stories that we have on the programme this evening, well, you can do so by contacting us by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get in touch at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
News Desk on Nearby Business.
So, Dave, lots happening business-wise at the moment, and an interesting story, a nice story to start with. The BAM CEO is to retire.
Yeah, the chief executive of civil engineering company, very big company indeed, BAM's Irish operations, is to retire from his role this summer. Theo Cullinan is a chartered engineer who has worked with BAM for 43 years, 13 as CEO and chairman of Royal BAM's group operations here in Ireland. He'll retire in June. During his time at the helm, he oversaw construction of some of the largest building projects in the state, delivering roads, bridges, hospitals, courthouses for the state and building offices and hotels for the private sector. Among the high-profile projects delivered in recent years are high-tech HQ campus at Leopardstown, the visual control tower at Dublin Airport, which looks like a Pez, you know that one?
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, really good. Yeah. The Boland's Quay development in Dublin South Docklands for Google, the Navigation Square development in Cork, includes also the Dean Hotel down there, the refurbishment and restoration of the city's criminal courts complex in Anglesey Street. BAM was also involved in the N11 Gorry to Enniscorthy and the new N25 New Ross public-private partnership scheme. The company had a turnover of $461 million in 2020, is involved in a number of ongoing large schemes around Ireland. In a statement, Mr. Cullinan said it has been an honour for him to spend his full professional career working for Royal BAM Group. I would like to thank the executive board and their steadfast support on the developments and new initiatives and diversification and sustainability over the years, he said. I thank my colleagues and partners for being on this journey with me and our clients for being so supportive for my work many years. 43 years, good career, and wish him all the best of luck there. Sounds like he's a Cork man, I think.
Best of luck to him, yeah. Cullinan, very good. Very big Cork name, all right, yeah. Now, Facebook and Insta were offline today for a while, Dave. Are we all okay?
OMG. I'm sure it was a really difficult time for many people. The issues accessing Facebook and Instagram have been resolved after the social media users reported problems accessing the sites. Now, many people reported outages for Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, but all three owned by Meta, Facebook's parent company. A Meta spokesperson said that the problem was caused by technical issues. Good old blanket
excuse
there.
Yeah.
Now there is a thing called Down Detector, a site that tracks and interruptions to websites, and there was a spike in reported outages, they said, on Facebook owned services this morning. As of 10 a.m. 2,000 people have reported outages on both Instagram and Facebook, and 600 have reported issues similar with WhatsApp. Earlier today, a technical issue caused some people to have trouble accessing apps and services, said the spokesperson. Resolved the issue as quickly as possible for everyone who was impacted, and they apologised for the inconvenience. Now, last year, the sites were down for several hours, affecting all of Facebook services. It said at that time that the cause of the outage was a configuration change to the backbone routers that coordinate network traffic between the company's data centres, which had a cascading effect, bringing all Facebook services to a halt.
Well, your backbone and your cascades, you want to keep them
have
right.
Have to lie down after that.
I'm out of breath even listening to you. Now, the state this week has reduced its stake in Bank of Ireland.
Yeah, the state has further reduced its stake in Bank of Ireland, bringing its shareholding in the bank to below 5%. In a statement to the Dublin Stock Exchange, the bank said the state's shareholding has reduced from 5.94% 0.5% to 4.93%. Francesca McDonagh, the group CEO, Bank of Ireland, said over the past 9 months, the state's shareholding in the Bank of Ireland Group has reduced by 2/3. The state is now the third largest shareholder in the group, she said. By the end of 2021, the bank had returned 6.2 billion to the state from its original support of 4.8 billion. Also mentioned there, the ongoing sales process adds to these returns is a positive process for our taxpayers, the Irish economy and Bank of Ireland. It's also a further important step towards normalisation of the state's relationship with Bank of Ireland. The state's 4.93% stake in the bank compares with its shareholding of 13.9% when it began the process of selling down some of its holdings in last June. In total, the state input was 4.7 billion into the bank during the financial crisis, with the initial investment coming in early 2009. Since then, the Bank of Ireland has returned more than 6 billion, as I said just a while ago, and this makes it the only Irish bank to have repaid the Irish taxpayer for its support. The current share sales process was due to conclude in January. However, last month, Minister for Finance Pascal Donoghue announced that its deadline would be extended until May this year.
I hope they're not finding it difficult to find buyers for it.
Yeah, well, at the moment, I suppose everything
is
probably slowed down.
It is indeed. Okay. In a moment or two now, we're going to be joined by economist Alan McQuaid, and we're going to have an in-depth look at the local, national and global economy. Where is it heading in these unprecedented times? We just thought it would be worthwhile to take a little bit of time out from what we usually do at this time in the programme and have a chat with Alan, who's been with us many times in the programme here and has some sound advice and some great guidance for us all. So we're going to do that in just a moment.
You're listening to Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM. Every Thursday at 6 p.m, the local, national and international business news headlines with a focus on what affects us here in Northeast Dublin. Regular features on the programme will include the Business Of section, where each week a different industry or industry leader will be here to chat about what makes their business work. The latest too in technology needed to make sure your business remains at the leading edge. HR issues will be discussed, as well as a particular focus on looking at matters from the employer's point of view. Being an entrepreneur can be a lonely pursuit, so there'll be a regular look at what supports are available for business in the local area. And a host of special features as well. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can text while the show is on the air to 087 69 44 500 or at any time on Twitter at @nearby_business. Near FM's business programme is Nearby Business.
Well, welcome back to the programme. This is Nearby Business on Near FM, the weekly business programme, your local business programme. And now, disposable incomes to fall for the first time since 2012 amid rampant inflation. And this is spread around by many economists at the moment. Disposable household incomes in Ireland are expected to fall this year in real terms for the first time in a decade, with consumer prices increasing at their fastest pace since the early 1980s against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine. Now, I'm joined by economist Alan McQuaid to take an in-depth look at where our local and national global economy is heading in these unprecedented times. Good evening, Alan. You're very welcome to the programme once again.
How are you, Dave? Yeah.
Good stuff. How are you?
Yeah, all good. I mean, despite what's going on in the world, I mean, very very frightening times, really, in terms of what's going on in Ukraine. But clearly, from a domestic point of view, not just domestically, but globally, this inflation story, you know, is going to be with us for a while yet, and unfortunately, as you say, it's going to hit consumers in the pocket big time.
Yeah, well, we had a very stable period there for many years, and like now, people in nearly a generation didn't understand what inflation was, because a lot of people are talking about the early 80s now, when 17% interest rates and no jobs in Ireland, people were emigrating and all that kind of thing. So recently we've seen petrol prices, you know, the pumps were going up overnight, and, you know, people were complaining and saying, realistically, I've never seen that. What's this thing, inflation? So yeah. Maybe can you explain how the dynamic works in this?
Well, I think, I mean, even going back then, I suppose a lot of the inflation was caused, the shocks were caused by energy prices, shortage of oil or whatever, these embargoes going back then, and which, you know, oil is such a big part of, you know, not just what we buy at the pumps, but I mean, energy itself goes into so many other things as well, that you know, that tends to be the biggest factor when inflation takes off. You get when economies do well, wages take off as well, which keeps pushing up prices, and it's self perpetuating in some ways. And I think we've had intermittent bouts of it in recent times, but I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen a lot of inflation in recently is that one of the arguments is that when you change to a new age, like the technology age, technology has changed so many things, and you know, that's had a big dampener on the world, really, keeping prices down. And I think there's greater competition there as well now. So you see it even in the small things here, like the arrival of the likes of Aldi and Lidl in here, in terms of the on the groceries element of it, and they're keeping, you know, the prices for the likes of the other major sort of local businesses down as well. So, you know, competition is always good. But now what we're seeing is sort of a confluence of factors, really. One, we've had so much money being pumped into the economies in recent years because of the global financial crisis, and then because of COVID. So much money just, you know, been thrown at it by the central banks and indeed by the governments.
Brexit in there as well.
Brexit, yeah. Then supply constraints because of China being a major player in the world, and they're following this zero COVID policy. So really, you know, they're a big factor in supply chains, and that's pushed up prices. And then of course we have the war now, which is only adding to things as well. And I think in some ways, central banks have been a bit too lax in recent years. I mean, there's an argument that maybe they should have raised rates and tightened policy a bit quicker than what they've done. Mm. But now, a lot of them are as the phrase that they use is behind the curve. I mean, they're, you see the US has already acted, the UK has already acted in terms of raising rates. The Eurozone, I think, it's been slow to react, and is still maintaining this policy that a lot of this is transitory. And a lot of it is, I mean, there are two types of inflation, really. One that is supply-driven, where just supply constraints, you know, for whatever reason, you know, whether it's because companies just aren't producing it or can't get it out because of COVID, or things like what we saw last year where oil tankers getting stuck in the Suez Canal, that you can't get the stuff out. That's one type of it. But the other one that I suppose is more worrying for central banks is demand driven, where demand is so aggressive that, and there's not enough supply to meet that demand. And you see that the obvious one here would be houses. We don't have enough houses, shortage of houses. So, you know, people going for a house are being outbid by people with more money, and that's pushing up, you know, the price of a house. So that's where we're. But I think at the moment, the ECB seems to think that it's more a supply issue. I think there's more to it than that. I think what we've seen is pent-up demand because of COVID. People, lots of savings there, and willing to get out now and spend. And plus the fact that all these businesses, whether it be, you know, restaurants, pubs, retailers, whatever, have taken a big hit during COVID, are now trying to make their money back. Mm. And you're seeing prices, you know, your pubs going up, whether it's for meals, eating out, or the price of a pint or whatever. So it's not just energy prices. There's a number of factors here, and which is why I think inflation will remain higher than what many people think. It'll remain higher for longer. You know, even if the oil situation improves, that of course assumes then that it'll improve because the Ukraine Russian situation gets better, but that's pretty questionable at the moment, unfortunately, in terms of what's going on, you know.
Can the EU as a bloc, actually, they're taking a kind of contrary view to the others at the moment, as you mentioned there. Can they soften the blow? Are they big enough to be able to do that and sort of say, well, no, actually, we're not going to increase rates just yet. We think it's probably going to get better. Is that something that can influence in it, or will they be behind the curve?
Well, I think ultimately, I mean, the problem for the ECB is that their principal mandate is price stability. And unlike the Federal Reserve in the US, which has a dual mandate, really, which is keeping prices under control, but also at the same time maintaining employment. So they've got a dual goal, whereas the principal mandate for the ECB is to make sure the prices are under control. Now, for many years, they were well below their expected target of 2%, fell well below that. But now, unfortunately, it's gone the other way. I think they're willing to to tolerate a bit of high inflation, because the worry that they have is that the Eurozone economy is not as strong as the US economy. And there's so, obviously there's 17 countries, and you know there's more countries in it there than, you know, than just one. So some of them are weaker than others, and Germany in particular has suffered in recent years. Obviously with COVID, auto production was hit, and auto production is a big part of the German economy. And Germany is highly dependent on natural gas from Russia as well.
Yeah,
so
that's a big
you know,
one, yeah.
If you sanction Russia, that Germany's going to take a hit. And Germany is the biggest economy in Europe. Even though it's a bit ironic, really, because Germany would be the ones who would tend to push more for higher rates, be more hawkish than some of the other countries in terms of raising rates. But I think their economy is probably more vulnerable than others to what's going on. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I still think the ECB probably should be raising rates, but you know, I think that in itself is not necessarily going to, you know, keep inflation down.
It creates a bit of hardship in its own way, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think you've already seen, I think last week, some of the banks here, in terms of their fixed rate mortgages, have gone up. The fixed rates tend to be priced off longer dated interest rates, like the bond market rates, rather than sort of short term rates that would affect sort of tracker mortgages or the variable rate, but it's already there's already signs that you know mortgage rates are, you know, will probably go up. Now they're obviously well below historical lows, but even with a slight rise, but that doesn't make it any easier for people who have a mortgage, because even a small percentage increase in rates can be very damaging in terms of disposable income. And as you say, you know, disposable income in real terms, when you strip out inflation out of it, it's going to be down for the first time in a number of years. So it's going to be very, very difficult. I think the KBC today, with their consumer sentiment survey, reckon that it's going to be an average hit of €2,000 per household with what's going on, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot, especially if people are at the pin of their collar with childminding and mortgages.
Yeah,
and
exactly. And so the question is how you respond to it. And unfortunately, you know, money doesn't grow on trees, and the government, I mean, clearly, you know, subsidises, or well, has said it's going to help with the energy bills to some degree. And you could argue that, and a lot of people have argued that maybe cutting taxes is probably the best way to go, because I think it's been pointed out, you know, the normal response to these things is get your employers to pay you more wages, because obviously, as an employee, and you're feeling the pinch, you're going to go to your employer and say, they'll give you more money. But all that does is then, it's a vicious circle, because really the employer then says, well, okay, I'll pay my staff more wages, but I'll get that money back by pushing up prices for my services or goods. So really, it's, you know, it doesn't get you anywhere. So I think the argument for lower taxes is probably the way to go. But unfortunately, I think, as we mentioned a number of times in this program before, Dave, I mean, we're not, in terms of our debt, in the best position, you know, globally. I think per capita, we're one of the highest.
Yeah, just the state borrowing, you know, versus our GDP. And like, even what's happening at the moment, in terms of the money that's been spent post COVID and Brexit, and then subsidies coming in, have they kind of just said, look, we'll deal with it later, we're just, let's keep getting keep printing the money?
Yeah, I think that's what I think. There's, I mean, it's an emergency response. I think they feel that I think there's even sort of, even at European level, I think they're sort of, let's turn a blind eye to sort of strict rules here, but for the time being. But it'll all have to be paid for eventually. So it's not as if, you know, it'll be free here. Yes, it's there's no such thing as a free lunch. There'll be payback time for this down the line, you know. So in terms of higher taxes or whatever, but you know, in the short term, it may well be that taxes are cut. And you know, more sort of measures are brought in to help, particularly the most vulnerable in what's going on at the moment, because it's going to be with us, you know, as I said, for some months yet. And I think inflation at the moment, I think it's just over 5.5%. And I think the SRI is talking about that could hit above 8.
Yeah, it's over 8, 6.7 to 8.5. Yeah, 6.7 to 8.5% is they said today. Yeah,
yeah.
Just in terms of like. There was a mention today by one of the politicians, I'm not sure if it was the Taoiseach, but there was a talk, and it was an off-the-cuff remark, I believe, and he said something like they were going to introduce a 30% income tax rate to help the squeezed middle. Is that something that they realistically will do?
Well, again, yeah, it looks good. It looks as if you're sort of you're there to try and help, and the squeeze middle is always the nice way to go about it. But again, I think he said he was going to ask Pascal Dunne, the Minister of Finance, to look at it. So obviously, what will happen is the staff and Department of Finance will be told to cost all this, and really that's where you go. I mean, what's the cost going to be to the Exchequer of doing this? I'd imagine. You know, it'll be only a temporary measure. Can't see it sort of lasting indefinitely, you know, because, I mean, it is going to cost, and if disposable income is hit, you know, and even if you get a tax cut, I mean, I would imagine that spending power will be down, so the receipts from VAT, etc., won't be as high as what they might have expected, you know, at the start of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it plays to the general public, and but again, you know, it's not going to be sort of, it might be a short term solution, but long term is again, it's going to put a pressure on the public finances.
In economic terms, just from your own experience and from historical, from, you know, the history of economics and that, in times of war and the mass migration of populations, how does that generally sort of settle down in the end? Like, obviously, if the war finished, today is a month since it began, and, you know, obviously people have to be looked after, people are on the move, it's dreadful, a humanitarian situation.
Yeah.
But for in terms of markets and things like that, do the markets get frightened with these things generally, don't they?
The markets get a fright, but then the stock markets tend to be very resilient, and you know, things will bounce back. And really, you know, the assumption will be that economies will return to normal, and you'll probably see what we've seen in, you know, the last, you know, number of years, roaring stock markets. And but there's always a shock around the corner, Dave, and you know, you don't know what's coming next. And
no.
You think if we're only 20 years into this century, we've already had the pandemic and financial crisis, this and now this war. But you could also argue that's what happened in the previous century.
That's
so
right, very similar.
You
know, yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
So
and a lot worse times, really, for a lot of people. Yeah.
Well, we don't want the Great Depression. That's certainly one thing we don't want. So, but you know, so history has doesn't often repeat, you know, doesn't repeat, but it could often rhyme. But
yes.
But there, you know, we've been here before, and we've got over it, and I've no doubt we get over it again. But it's difficult times for everybody. Clearly, you know, I think in terms of the migration and the people coming in, there's a lot of issues there that haven't been thought out. But I mean, I think they just don't have time to do it. It's just got to act immediately. It's an emergency. Clearly, the one that's the most pressing would be housing, and because there's no doubt that there's a shortage of houses or accommodation for people, for you know, the domestic people here, people who are, you know, striving on the housing ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So, where are you going to fill? You know, where are you going to find a combination of all these people coming in? You know,
yeah.
So it's only going to add pressure there, and it's a political hot potato. So there's so many things there that have to be looked at. But I think in the current climate and we see what's going on, you know, it has to be done. It's an emergency. You know, women and children there, you know, just being forced out of their own country. It's absolutely shocking stuff, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There will be a cost to it. You know, in more ways than one, it won't be just a loss of life. There will be a cost economically down the road, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Declan here. Just in terms of is there any part of the economy or any part of business that could actually do well out of this? Like, I'm thinking of when you're talking there about interest rates rising. I presume that businesses that have cash and have money will actually benefit from that.
Yeah, banks tend to be the ones that do well out of it, you know.
Yeah.
So if you're, and you've seen today, again, Bank of Ireland, sort of their shareholder being sort of government cutting their holding in Bank of Ireland. So Bank of Ireland now has paid more money back than it's actually gotten a loan from the bailout. So banks tend to do, so there will be people that will do well. There's always, you know, sectors that can do well out of it. Obviously, people lending businesses, you know, are the ones that benefit most from it. But like, I think at the moment, I mean, I think with Ireland is that it's a strange sort of situation. Is that because we have this sort of high concentration of multinationals here, and they're obviously going to again cushion the sort of overall damage to the economy because the nature of pharmaceuticals and IT will continue to probably do okay. But domestically, I think there will be businesses. I think at local level. I think if disposable income comes under pressure, people are going to spend less, and particularly on discretionary spending. You will spend on the essentials, but the other things on discretionary spending, won't be as much. So therefore, I think some businesses there are going to suffer. I mean, the normal things that people spend the money on, food and energy. And clothing and that sort of stuff, they'd probably be all right. But it's the sort of glamour stuff, when you're buying these sort of 55-inch TVs and all this, and the new cars and all that. Everyone's going to suffer when disposable income goes down. And
I suppose people don't use their savings either. If there's an attractive interest rate, you might leave the money in the bank.
That's one of the good things about. People haven't benefited from interest rates. Yeah. Savers haven't benefited from high interest rates at all. So that's the only good thing really for that rates going up, is that savers get a higher return. Not that much higher given that the rates are so low as they are. But for at least it's something. But yeah, I think it's unfortunately it's obviously the same cohort. It's the younger sort of generation who are going to take the bigger hit here. The ones who can't climb the ladder in the first place, the property ladder. If mortgage has gone up now, it's going to make it more difficult. I mean, people will say, "Oh, mortgage, higher rates then might sort of help in the housing market." I'm not too sure about that because it seems to be a lot of money. Anecdotally, from what I'm hearing, that people, a lot of people have money, cash, whether it's people from overseas or whatever, or people who have had huge savings from before, and they're able to outbid sort of the younger sort of cohort who are trying to get on that property ladder. So I think the housing element is going to be critical, and as I said, I mean, the influx of all these people from Ukraine doesn't help in terms of of easing the world. If anything, it's going to put more pressure on the system. So how that's addressed, it remains to be seen, but
It's definitely going to be a challenge. It's fascinating.
Probably plays into the hands of the opposition more so than
the government.
Who I think have already admitted that it's going to take, even if it's to build sort of prefabs or whatever, sort of different mobile homes, whatever to do, for these people. It's not going to be done overnight. It's going to take years rather than weeks.
Well, Alan, it's fascinating, and as usual, we appreciate you taking the time there. We've probably taken much more of your
very
time
enjoyable
than we thought.
And always a pleasure to listen to you. When we get you on, we like to drain every last drop out of you. We get good economy when you're on the programme. You're a mine of information, and we love having you on the show. And thank you very much for talking to Nearby Business. Alan McQuaid, economist.
Thanks, David Declan. Cheers.
Thanks, Alan. Fascinating. You could talk about it all day and all night. Yeah.
It's kind of common sense, right? But it's common sense in a kind of, you do too much of this and do too much of that, or you haven't got enough of that. And, it's like...
And the levers are great. I love you. Yeah. Do a bit of this and pull a bit of that and see does it help. And, and all the various permutations and accommodations. But it's a challenge for many people just to keep going, for sure as well, and many businesses as well. We have to keep that in mind. Now, coming up in the second half of the show, and thanks again to Alan for that in-depth look at the local, national and global economy, where we're going in these unprecedented times. But coming up in the second part of the show, in a few moments, Jenny Tyrrell will have her radio column. And this week, the radio column is about Bord Gáis, and they're looking at alternative energy sources, and they're looking at biomethane. Conor Burke will be here with This Business Week in History, and David Bell will be here as well, David from the HR department. And this week we're going to look at managing boomerang employees, and I'm sure have time for a little bit of any other business before we finish up as well at 7. So all of that, Dave, to come here on Nearby Business.
Download a podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM.
Do you speak tech? Do you speak tech?
Do you speak tech?
Do you speak tech?
Do you speak Quebec?
Do you speak tech?
Do you speak tech?
Yes, I do. Don't miss a bite and listen to me every Thursday at 7 p.m. on Near FM.
From Mount Prospect Avenue to St. Paul's.
From 1967 to 1997.
Classic rock, metal, punk, goth, and much more.
Tune into the Grove Radio Show on Near FM 90.3.
Relive those teenage kicks with your favourite songs from the Grove. Listener playlists and memories.
Join Lynn Kavanagh, Jennifer Roach and Brian Tucker every second Friday from 9.30 to 11.30pm as we remember those teenage years.
Dedicated to the memory of DJ Cecil Nolan.
The Digital Experience. Missed a programme or an interview? Catch up now online with the Near FM Digital Experience. We're online 24 hours a day, podcasting every day. Visit nearfm.ie/podcast.
90.3. This is Near FM.
And welcome back. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air at 087-6944-500 or any time on Twitter at @nearby_business #localbiz.
And next we've got Jenny Tyrrell with our weekly radio column, and this week Jenny takes a look at why Bord Gáis is looking at biomethane.
Taking care of business on Nearby Business.
We're going green. We're going green. We're gonna take care of the earth. We're going green.
Ireland has an ambitious vision to transform into a low-carbon society and economy by 2050. While significant progress has been made to date in the decarbonisation of industrial energy and electricity generation, there is a recognition that more can and must be done to address other areas, such as heating and transport, which also generate significant volumes of greenhouse gases. This week, Gas Networks Ireland has welcomed a letter sent to the government by IBEC, the business and employer group, calling for measures to support energy security, including the development of biomethane and hydrogen projects in Ireland. Currently, gas plays a key role in Ireland's energy system, providing approximately 30% of the country's primary energy needs. It provides an effective source of heat for households and businesses, which are connected to the gas network and is safe and modern by global standards. Biomethane is a carbon-neutral renewable gas, which is structurally identical to natural gas, and is made from farm and food waste through a process known as anaerobic digestion, or AD. Cheaper than natural gas, it has already begun to replace natural gas in the national network. Hydrogen, which is a carbon-free flammable gas that can be made from renewable electricity, such as wind, and can be stored until needed, and it is another attractive option to decarbonise Ireland's energy system. While currently there is no hydrogen on Ireland's gas network, it is believed that blends of up to 20% could be transported on the existing infrastructure today. During Gas Networks Ireland's Biomethane Industry webinar back in September, more than 270 interested parties, including farmers, developers and industry bodies, heard how agriculturally produced biomethane can be delivered sustainably and at scale to decarbonise Ireland's energy system. Farmers use gas to produce most fertiliser, and there are now fears of huge increase in food price inflation over the coming weeks. Greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture represent over 35% of national emissions and are expected to increase further due to projected increase in dairy cow numbers and proposals to increase food production and exports, as set out in Food Harvest 2020. Ireland needs to address emissions from agriculture, which could threaten the Origin Green sustainability status of Ireland's food and drink production internationally. Gas Networks Ireland introduced domestically produced biomethane into the national network in 2019 via the country's first dedicated renewable gas injection point in Cush, County Kildare. A second renewable gas injection facility in Corricunna, Gary Lee, Mitchelstown was approved by Cork County Council and on board Planala in 2020. Although the quantity produced is still quite small, together they have the capacity to heat 75,000 homes while also supporting the decarbonisation of local agriculture. It is also fully compatible with existing appliances, technology and vehicles. The Renewable Gas Forum of Ireland, the ORGFI, welcomed the announcement with Chief Executive PJ McCarthy, saying the major shift in policy at European level will resonate across member states. He said, "Ireland is a bit behind the rest of Europe in producing biomethane, and action is urgently required in terms of capital grants to build anaerobic digestion plants and introducing a renewable heat obligation scheme as a fair and stable means to socialise costs and accelerate the deployment of AD biomethane to address security of supply and energy prices." Gas Networks Ireland's Innovation and Business Development Manager Ian Kilgallen said that across Europe, biomethane is seen as a vital solution for decarbonisation energy systems, while also providing a more sustainable solution for farmers to reduce their waste and emissions. In countries around Europe, including the UK, Italy, France and Germany, biomethane is playing an important role in decarbonising sectors such as heat and transport. Within both the EU's farm-to-fork strategy and the Irish agri-food industry, the development of biomethane and the production of a nutrient-rich biofertilizer digestate, which is a byproduct of anaerobic digestion, is seen as another major element. For the last 12 months, we have seen increased energy costs and announced this week additional raises are proposed for April, where electricity and gas bills are to go up 27% and 39% respectively. Petrol and diesel has hit an all-time high, stretching businesses to their limits, exacerbated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What's quite shocking is, after two tough years in business for most, is the size and scale of the increase, which is unprecedented. Currently, the EU imports 90% of its gas, with Russia providing around 45% of those imports, plus 25% of oil imports and 45% of coal imports. Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said, "We must become independent from Russian oil, coal and gas. We simply cannot rely on a supplier who explicitly threatens us." She discussed REPowerEU with European leaders last week. In a week of turmoil, there were also calls for other emergency measures in Ireland, including bigger cuts to fossil fuel prices, reduced carbon taxes, supporting fertiliser purchases and lifting a ban on commercial peat harvesting. EU farmers say REPowerEU bids to take biomethane from 3 billion cubic metres now to 35 billion cubic metres under the objective plan Fit for 55, where the EU planned to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 55% by the year 2030. In his letter to Taoiseach Micheál Martin, IBEX CEO Danny McCoy called on the government to introduce new measures to protect Irish businesses from high energy costs and to enhance Ireland's energy security. The CEO said the invasion of Ukraine exposed the fragility of Europe's energy system, its dependence on fossil gas from Russia, and the failure to decarbonise and diversify Ireland's energy mix. Director of Customer and Business Development at Gas Networks Ireland, David Kelly, said, "We strongly welcome IBEX's ask of the government to support the development of hydrogen and biomethane projects to both enhance the country's energy security and provide opportunities to create a renewable gas industry in rural Ireland." He added, "The vision of Gas Networks Ireland is to replace natural gas with renewable gases such as biomethane and hydrogen. Replacing natural gas with renewable gases will help to significantly reduce carbon emissions nationwide while ensuring a secure energy supply in the least disruptive and most cost-effective manner." United Drug is one such company who has made the switch to biomethane as part of the company's efforts to become carbon neutral by 2030, supplied by Flowgas Enterprise. The biomethane, which is currently sourced from Green Generation in Cush, County Kildare, will increase incrementally in the coming years. Flowgas Enterprise are the first company to offer the renewable gas to commercial customers in Ireland. The Irish Bioenergy Association, or the IRBEA, and CREA, a forum to discuss composting and anaerobic digestion, have a vision of 25 biogas plants near the gas grid with feedstock primarily from agriculture products and residues. Each plant would require feedstock from farmers and pay €35 per tonne of grass fresh weight. Along with playing a key role in meeting national and EU climate action targets in the future and reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, there is a significant scope for biomethane production in Ireland, a domestic biomethane industry, but also provide significant opportunities for rural communities. It will create 3,000 sustainable jobs, with just 2% of the country's farmland supplying the raw material, while also facilitating a sustainable circular economy, since businesses could power their own operations using renewable gas made from their own waste. According to IRBEA, there has been complete government inaction to date on realising Ireland's huge bioenergy potential, and it's taken the invasion of Ukraine for them to sit up and take note. As Robert Swan, OBE, the first man in history to walk to both the North and South Pole, said, "The greatest threat to our planet is the belief that someone else will save it." This is a love song to the earth.
And as usual, Jenny, thanks a million for looking at that topic there, Bordgas, looking at biomethane, Dave. Looking for, you know, new energy supplies with the war and with, you know, difficulty getting natural gas across the pipelines. Just looking at alternative energies, and IBEC there calling on them to look at it and trying to come up with just something to make sure that the supply of energy is maintained. So
yeah, very important. They did many years ago, 20 years ago, perhaps more. Dunsink was mined for that. They actually went in and took biogas out of the hill there. You can see it on the
wow.
M50.
Yeah.
Because there had been a dump since the 60s, like people
yes.
just down, and then the kind of emphasis had changed from landfill to sort of, so now you can only put sort of organic material into the land and not plastic and all that. We used to go up and throw everything off the back of your car, and yeah. then they'd dig another hole and you do the rest of it.
Cover it up.
But the consequence of this was that it actually built up pockets of gas in the ground, so they set up these generators up there to take it out of the ground. Now, I don't know how it ever finished, but I do remember that actually happening, and I was involved at one point there in the engineering side of it at that time, yeah. in the 1990s. So
maybe not economically viable or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think it was out. Probably yeah. but wouldn't yeah. probably be big enough, you know. That's yeah. probably what it was. It probably wasn't big enough
yeah.
Sort of to be sustained. And biogas does come off sewage plants and things like that as well, so it has to be collected and used and stored and
harvested
and all that kind of stuff.
Now, we were talking about banks a little bit earlier on there, and we have talked about banks leaving. Obviously KBC and Ulster Bank are on their way out, but Revolut is a name that people would be familiar with, but they weren't actually a bank until now.
Yeah, they've officially begun operating as a bank in the Republic with the launch of protected deposit accounts for Irish customers. The fintech, which has 18 million customers globally and 1.7 million in Ireland, said it's operationalised its European specialist banking licence here. The result is that Irish customers can upgrade to Revolut Bank to avail of additional services. These include deposit accounts, personal accounts with rates starting from 5.99 APR. Revolut said the upgrade process to become a banking customer only takes a few minutes and can be all done via its mobile app. The launch of Revolut Bank comes amid a period of change in local banking sector here, with both KBC and Ulster Bank exiting the market. The launch of Revolut Bank comes after FinTech recently dropped plans to use an e-money licence it had secured from the Central Bank of Ireland. The company, which was awarded a full banking licence by the European Central Bank in December, said last month it intended to use the licence to offer services including personal loans to customers here rather than the one approved by the Irish regulator. Now, interesting to see that there's 1.7 million users in Ireland. Revolut is one of the fastest growing fintech companies in Europe because they say themselves, we put the customer at the heart of everything we do. Our customer experience is second to none, and we have no hidden fees, and we're constantly building new and innovative financial products. And that's Joe Heenan, Chief Executive of Revolut Bank, said.
Excellent. Yeah, it's good to see competition coming. Of course, N26, we talked about a couple of weeks ago as well, another new bank entity, if you like, in the mm-hmm. market here as well. So good to see that with the other ones going. It'll keep everybody on their toes. Now, Conor Burke is here next with this Business Week in History.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hello, my name is Conor Burke, and welcome back to This Week in History, the segment where I talk about one important event that happened in this week in the past. On the 21st of March 2014, the EU and the US imposed sanctions on Russia in retaliation for the Russian annexation of Crimea. The sanctions targeted state-owned banks and sensitive technology. As well as that, the European Union announced an arms embargo on Russia. The US then followed suit and announced sanctions on major Russian banks like energy, weapons and finance. Three Russian banks were also cut off from the US economy. They were the Bank of Moscow, Bank of Agriculture and Bank OAO. The effects of the sanctions hit the Russian public hard. The cost of living rose and the ruble fell in value. EU exports to Russia were down 14% from 2013 to 2014, which meant goods and services were not being made available to the Russian people. The sanctions also had a negative impact on certain EU member states, like Cyprus for example, where exports were down 78% in 2014 compared to 2013. The reason for this is because they mainly exported goods to Russia, and that was affected by the sanctions. In 2015, total exports from the EU to Russia was worth 73.8 billion euros, compared to in 2014, where it was worth 119.4 billion euros. It's impossible to look at the sanctions imposed on Russia in 2014 and not draw a comparison to the ones that are being imposed on Russia as we speak. The major difference between the ones in 2014 and the sanctions imposed today is that the sanctions in 2014 were a punishment for the annexation of Crimea, where the ones that are being imposed at the moment are designed to cripple and destabilize Russia. Assets of wealthy Russians are being seized all around the world at the moment, like in Germany, where the Russian oligarch Alisher Yuvashov had his mega yacht seized by the German government. Likewise in England, Roman Abramovich has been forced to sell his football club Chelsea. And also another part of the sanctions is that lots of foreign businesses have closed their doors in Russia, leaving shopping malls and shopping streets looking bare. The sanctions have also caused the cost of living to increase again, at a time where lots of Russians are newly unemployed because of the sanctions. Lots of global businesses are moving out. But Russia could hit back because the EU gets most of its gas and oil from Russia, so there is a threat that Russia could stop supplying gas and oil, and that could cause havoc in Europe. The dependence on Russian oil has become about because of the widespread closure of nuclear power stations across the continent, and also that oil reserves in the Baltic Sea and the Netherlands have dried up. Ireland won't be directly impacted if Russia cut their oil supply to the EU, as we receive most of our oil and gas from the Nordic states like Denmark and Sweden. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of This Week in History. Tune in next week to find out what historic events happened then. Thank you. Bye.
And thanks a million to Connor for a look at this business week in history. And Connor's a media student and he's looking for some experience. And myself and Dave have given him the opportunity to get that here on Nearby Business. We wish him well and good luck with his studies as well. Next up is David Bell.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
I'm joined now by David Bell from the HR department for our usual look at HR issues from the employer's point of view. Good evening, David.
Evening, Declan.
David, today we're going to talk about an interesting concept and an interesting topic, I suppose, and that is one of managing boomerang employees. Now, I suppose a little definition of that might be the best place to start. What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose the hint might be in the title, Declan. So a boomerang is basically an employee who has left a company or an organization and have basically come back. It is not very common. I suppose most people who move on from an organization tend to stay that way. But there are people who do come back under different situations. And we've just noticed particularly, you know, without mentioning the COVID word constantly, but sort of around COVID, there's been so many changes and so much rejigging and people coming and going that this is something that companies are facing. So it really is just people who have left an organization and, you know, some are coaxed back. Others who left may find that, you know, what they thought where the grass was greener and the new workplace may not be the case, and they're looking to return to their old workplace. So that's where the expression boomerang, basically someone coming back.
Very good. Yeah. And I suppose, yeah, I know you did mention the COVID word. It's hard to get away from it. But I suppose during that period of time, there were lots of businesses who had to downsize and had to maybe, you know, unfortunately, let some of the employees, you know, let them go or put them on leave or whatever. And maybe they never got reconnected when things started to pick up. And maybe some of those businesses are picking up. So it could be that sort of dynamic as well, really, in this situation.
Exactly. I mean, that's, as you say, quite specific to this particular situation that we find ourselves in. Yeah. So it could be that because of the situation that arose, that the people had left, or you know, they couldn't have been retained, and therefore they may not have got a job, or they may have got a job. But as things improve, perhaps companies are looking to rehire people, perhaps who they either had to let go or who left because there wasn't work for them. Yeah. So it's not unique to this situation. It does happen across any time, but I suppose there are, as there has been all along, unusual situations that have arisen because of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose we tend to try and look at things here on the business programme, on Nearby Business here. We tend to look at it from the employer's point of view. So I suppose the question is, from an employer's point of view, is it a good thing or a bad thing for somebody to be coming back to you?
Well, like all these things, it can be a blessing or a curse, as they say. So, you know, the positive side, obviously someone has worked in the organization before. They would have experience. They would have certain maybe skills and knowledge of the organization, the company, and they'd obviously, you would hope, would bring something to the table, so to speak. On the other hand, if there has been issues maybe in the past, and these could be individuals that have been gone for some time, so maybe things that have occurred that there isn't a huge knowledge of in the organization, but there may be people who were there before. And there may not be. So I mean, there could be situations that are well forgotten, or the knowledge of the situation isn't still in the organization. So I think it has its pros and cons, like everything else. And I think it's up to employers to weigh that up. You know, sometimes it can be that there is a particular shortage of experience or skills or knowledge within an organization, and they will maybe reach out to someone who has been in a previous employee. And often then it could just be someone applying for a job or approaching the organization, or, you know, the managing director or their manager, saying, look, you know, that decision I made to go hasn't really worked out, or, you know, on second thoughts, I'd like to see if there's an opportunity to come back. Or it could just be applying for a job that's advertised. So, you know, it does have its pros and cons, like all these things. So I think it's just trying to weigh those two options up.
Indeed, yeah. And I suppose in most organisations of any reasonable size, there would be a file on employees. So even if there is a change of, you know, senior people or managers or whatever in the company, it might be a good idea to look up the HR file as well, I presume.
Exactly. If there was some information within the company, or there may be people, as you say, who are there or may have some knowledge, but certainly if there was a file, just to see, is there anything there that, you know, might give you some guidance? Is there, were there issues, or was it just that, you know, as with a lot of people, there's no presumption that things didn't work out. If someone leaves, it's often for, you know, career development and advancement, and people wish them well. So yeah, but it's a good idea to maybe check to see, was there anything there that could give cause for concern, or alternatively to maybe affirm that the person is actually a very, very good employee and would be someone that they would welcome back.
Yeah, and I presume on the way back in, they would have to go through a normal recruitment process. So, you know, interview and reference checks and all the usual sort of rigor and process that would happen around hiring somebody. I mean, just because they've been in the organisation before wouldn't mean you could forgo that due diligence, would it?
Not at all. I mean, again, I suppose there are situations perhaps where someone has worked in the organization and has reached, maybe at a particular point in time, has reached as far as they could go, and they leave to maybe get experience in a particular area in another company. And then, you know, if there's a change in the previous employer, they can come back. And that sometimes happens. You see someone, you know, maybe reaching in a sort of a marketing or in finance or in, you know, some technical area where they've reached, you know, a point where they feel they have to leave to gain more experience, but that they are, you know, they keep in touch, and I suppose they could be approached, or they could keep in contact with the more senior people. So an opportunity arises, and that you sometimes see that happens in a place that I worked, where a number of my colleagues left around the same time I did, and I see then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, they're back in a different role, a more senior role. And that sometimes maybe as a result of a conversation that's been had, and it doesn't necessarily go through a full rigor of recruitment. But I think by and large, yeah, I think we can take it in for this discussion that the person does apply for a job and that the normal rules would apply. Obviously, as I said before, they have some experience at the organization, they've been hired before, type of thing. But you don't want to just give them the impression that because they've worked there before, that they would automatically get a job just because they've been there before. They would have to go through, you know, an interview process, as would be norm.
Yeah, and so no free pass. I suppose then when you get people back in, so you've gone through the process or whatever due diligence or checking has been done, and you decide to rehire the person, and they come back in and everybody's happy with that. Is there a little bit of work required then, maybe slightly differently to normal, or maybe not that different, but when you get that person back into the business, I presume you want to put in maybe some checks and balances and I don't like to use the word monitoring, but I think you probably know what I mean. Just checking maybe that everything is okay.
Yeah, exactly. And look, again, it's going back to what we discussed at the beginning, you know, what are they bringing to the organization? Is there pros and cons? So yeah, I think it would be normal. You know, they would obviously have to go through any process. Things have changed. It depends on the length of time that they've been away. Obviously, personnel would be significantly different. They may have moved location. There may be different practices and procedures that weren't there. So they would have the normal sort of induction that everyone else would, unless they didn't leave within a very short period of time they were back. Yeah. And then, as you say, Declan, I think some, you know, again, monitoring is probably, it may be seen to be strong, but I think everyone would make sure that the person settles in, even if they've worked there before. It doesn't mean that they're just going to go straight back in. And I think, particularly if there have been issues in the past, I think we'd check in with them to make sure that they're settling in and that what you hired them or rehired them for are on show, and that maybe there were some issues that they had in the past that they are, you know, not an issue anymore, or are being managed and monitored if there is issues before, that they can be addressed early enough and not allow things that maybe creep in that were there before that caused them to leave in the first place.
Yeah, indeed, it's important to do that and just check, and communication, as is the case with most of these things, is probably key to this as well. Just two-way communication.
You say and explain that, you know, this would be the sort of standard practice. They're not particularly keep an eye on this individual, but
yeah,
you know, frank and open discussion is always very useful in these situations, so everyone knows what's going on. And I think that's a very good piece of advice. Exactly.
Yeah, and I think we started off talking about the grass being greener on the other side. I'll give you a little bit of a personal story as well, and the listeners. I myself at one point was a Boomerang employee. The organisation that I currently work for in my day job, I was there for about 3 years, and saw a role in another organisation which definitely thought looked a bit greener. Went, and when I got there after about a month, I saw that the grass was brown, probably not green, and decided to go back to the company that I'd left. And they actually hadn't replaced my role, so I went back in exactly doing what I'd been doing 8 weeks later, and I'm now there 32 years.
Well, there you go. So you're a live example.
A live example.
But that's a positive end. That's a positive way, and that's what I'm saying. It's not to focus on negative. And I'm sure you left in that short space of time. There wasn't huge, but it's good to show that there was no hard feelings, and obviously, you know, that's great that they accept you back and that you've obviously the right decision if you've been there that long. That's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the better decisions I made. One of the worst decisions I made to go, and one of the better decisions I made to come back. So there you go. There's, as you say, a real life example. David, thanks a million for giving us those tips and for that discussion on managing boomerang employees, people who come back to you, and a real life personal example there of how it can work out in a positive way. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Declan.
AOB on Nearby Business.
Just time to squeeze in some AOB. Dave, you have an interesting story there for us.
Just around the wires today, fund administration firm BNY Mellon Fund Services Ireland have been fined 10.78 million by the Central Bank of Ireland for regulatory breaches related to the outsourcing of activities. In total, the regulator found the firm had breached 16 regulations between July 2013 and December 2019, including through the provision of inaccurate and misleading information. The duration of the breaches ranged from 26 days up to 6 years. The fine represents the largest financial penalty imposed on a fund service provider here and is among the largest ever levied by the Central Bank on any regulated entity. The Central Bank probe found that the BNY Mellon did not have in place an adequate outsourcing governance framework and also failed to comply with its regulatory obligations in respect of outsourcing. The investigation also concluded the firm did not engage openly and transparently with the regulator once breaches of its obligations were identified by the Central Bank.
Yep. Get the governance right and then engage with the regulator if there's a problem, is the message there. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Nearby Business. Thanks a million to all our contributors again this evening, and we'll both be back live here at 6 p.m. next Thursday evening.
In the meantime, don't forget, if you have an idea or would like to discuss anything with us, get in touch on Twitter anytime at nearby_business, hashtag local biz. So for me, Dave Daly,
and myself, Declan Ralph, bye for now, and we'll see you soon on the radio.
Thanks.
Bye bye.